This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight,
a ceasefire has taken effect in South Sudan's war-torn Yei River State. The deal was signed Sunday in Uganda between a breakaway faction from the SPLA in opposition and the government. But top opposition SPLM-IO leaders say they do not recognize the deal.
That's Halima Othmani reporting from Kampala. We'll have full details coming up. Also, a shaky ceasefire is reported in effect in South Sudan's Yei River State. A violent protest in the Gambia last Friday left one person dead. We'll find out why discontent and deadly protests are some of the problems facing Gambia's new president. And the new faces of HIV have defied the odds by living for decades with the disease. We'll have these stories and more. Stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a ceasefire has taken effect in South Sudan's Yei River State. The deal was signed yesterday in Uganda between a breakaway faction from the SPLA in opposition and the government. But top opposition SPLM-IO leaders say they do not recognize the deal. Halima Othmani reports from Kampala.
The peace agreement for Yei River State came after a four-day joint military committee meeting in Kampala to discuss a cessation of hostilities, permanent ceasefire, national dialogue, and the opening of all roads leading to and from Yei Town in South Sudan. The key agreement was the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition agreed to declare a permanent ceasefire and for both sides to ensure Yei River State is not a battleground. Brigadier General Hilary Edson Yakani represented the SPLA in opposition and explained some of their demands.
We have seen that there are a lot of challenges, especially from the behavior of some military persons who were misusing their positions in mishandling our citizens. So this is one of our greatest demands, asking the government to bring in a well-balanced national army who really handle people with all respect and what is really required of a national army.
Lead government negotiator Major General Marshal Stephen Babanen says the agreement signed Sunday is going to be fully operational in 18 weeks, including the integration of the former rebels into the National Army.
We have signed the agreement and the permanent ceasefire. They are going to move to pre-assembly areas, which will take them 1 to 2 weeks. And then in the third week, they will go to the assembly area where all activities of screening, training and integration will take place.
But when VOA contacted the main opposition SPLM-IO deputy spokesman, Kanolam Paul Gabriel, he said they do not recognize the group led by Brigadier General Yakani. Gabriel said those who signed the fake peace deal are individuals who deserted opposition leader Riek Machar. But Yakani says he represents more than 16,000 armed troops in Yei River State.
When we went to the booth, we did not sign a document with Riek Machar, but we all went to the booth because there was a problem. So now that we are coming back, we command the forces in Yei River State. It's not Riek Machar who commands the forces.
The agreement was a result of a request from South Sudan's President Salva Kiir to Uganda's Yoweri Museveni. The grassroots peace initiative process follows a January visit to Yei by Kiir. Yei was a headquarter of the SPLA during the struggle with Sudan and has been at the heart of the fighting in South Sudan. The UN Human Rights Office released a report in May alleging pro-government forces killed at least 114 civilians in and around Yei Town from July 2016 to January 2017. The army has denied these allegations. Yei Town was considered mostly peaceful until the flare-up of violence in July 2016 following Machar's departure from Juba. Since that time, many residents have fled, often to refugee settlements in neighboring Uganda. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Vote counting continues in Lesotho, which held a snap election on Saturday, its third vote in 5 years. Observers say they hope this election will finally bring stability to a nation that has been rocked by political drama in recent years. This vote again pitted the ruling coalition led by the Democratic Congress against an opposition bloc led by the All Basotho Convention, or ABC. The ABC made a strong showing in early vote counts, decisively winning many districts in its traditional strongholds in the capital. The leader of the opposition, Tom Tabane, handily won his district on the outskirts of the capital with just over 77% of the vote. Tabane told journalists he was confident of victory and would embark immediately on a program of reforms. He highlighted Lesotho's troubled history with the military, which has been accused of political meddling and which Tabane says forced him to flee the country in 2014. On Saturday, uniformed soldiers appeared at several polling stations in the capital, prompting concerns of voter intimidation and leading the observer mission to launch a probe into why the soldiers were there. But late afternoon on Monday, the Electoral Commission had yet to announce results from several rural districts seen as ruling party strongholds. A violent protest in the Gambia last Friday left one person dead and several others seriously wounded, although longtime ruler Yahya Jammeh left the country after losing December's election. His supporters are protesting the continued presence of West African ECOWAS troops. The discontent and protest are some of the problems facing Gambia's new president, Adama Barrow. To learn more, VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke to Pandarium Bai, editor and founder of the Freedom Online newspaper.
Joe, it all started to unfold in the early hours of Friday when some disgruntled residents of Kanilai took to the streets demanding for the immediate withdrawal of the ECOWAS forces from the village. Kanilai is the home village of the former Gambian dictator, Yahya Jammeh. It is situated in the west coast region of the Gambia, about 118 kilometers from the capital city, Banjul. The villagers, mainly youth, women, and elderly people, on tires where the ECOWAS forces had a checkpoint. They chanted anti-ECOWAS and Senegalese sentiments. The protesters said they do not want foreign forces occupation in the village. They also said they want the return of former President Yahya Jammeh. Things escalated to a violent confrontation when the Senegalese forces fired live bullets at the protesters, killing 54-year-old Haruna Jatta, a native of Kanilai, leaving six others injured. Joe, as we speak, two of the injured protesters are said to be suffering from life-threatening injuries.
How long have ECOWAS forces been in that part of the Gambia?
ECOWAS forces have been in the Gambia since the withdrawal of President Jammeh from the presidency. This was sometime back in December. They started protecting the Barrow government. They promised to patrol and also maintain internal security in the country. But the relations between the ECOWAS forces and the Gambian population, especially those resident in the Fonyi area, the birthplace of former President Yahya Jammeh, has not been very cordial, Joe.
Has the government of Adama Barrow responded to the protest?
Yes. Interior Minister Mai Fati, who was attending an ECOWAS summit in Monrovia, Liberia, with President Adama Barrow over the weekend, had to cut short his trip to return to Banjul to address the pressing national security challenges. In his speech, Mr. Fati said the protesters were armed with traditional weapons, in his own words, some of whom he alleged crossed the border from neighboring Senegal to take part in the protests. It is imperative to note that these protest videos shared on social media, there was no evidence to that effect to confirm the minister's assertion. There is this long-time perception held by the Senegalese government that Fonyi is a rebel hideout. The former President Yahya Jammeh has been accused of harboring MFDC rebels fighting for independence in the southern province of Casamance. As such, the Senegalese forces decided to deploy heavy military presence in the area. The people living in the neighborhood in the area felt intimidated by the heavy military presence. Minister Mai Fati also said about 20 people have been arrested. The village alcalde of Kanilai and others, they are also in the hiding. Some even fled to neighboring Casamance.
Pandiri, has there been any response from ECOMOG officials?
I spoke to the ECOMOG commander in the Gambia, Colonel Njai, to get his own version of what transpired, what happened. And Colonel Njai said the matter is being investigated, but he said at this time he's not going to comment further. They're trying to wait for the outcome of the investigations.
That's Pandiri Mbai, editor and founder of the online Freedom newspaper. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Another migrant-related tragedy is being reported today. AFP says 7 sub-Saharan African migrants have been found dead in an abandoned refrigerator truck near the Libyan capital, Tripoli. 35 others have been found alive, but most needed medical treatment. Migrants are often smuggled by truck across southern Libya en route to the coast. It's a 300-kilometer journey during which migrants are often exploited and abused, including sexually abused by smugglers. Migrants hope to reach the Libyan coast to begin crossing the Mediterranean to Europe. Heavy rains and strong winds in northeastern Nigeria have worsened the humanitarian crisis for thousands of displaced people. The International Organization for Migration says thousands of shelters have been destroyed, affecting at least 4,300 people in Jere, Kaga, and Kanduga, and the Borno state capital of Maiduguri. AFP reports the storms struck on June 2nd and 3rd, damaging camps and makeshift settlements for those displaced by the Boko Haram insurgents. The rainy season has just begun in northeastern Nigeria and is expected to last 3 or 4 months. In related news, hundreds of displaced people in northern Cameroon are deserting camps near the Nigerian border, saying they no longer feel safe after a series of suicide bombings. The government is appealing for calm. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from the city of Kolofata.
Nine infants cry for assistance at the Kolofata Central Mosque on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. The mosque is now a sanctuary for 70 people who began escaping a nearby camp for internally displaced persons last Friday, after 2 suicide bombers disguised as refugees begged for food and blew themselves up. Nearly a dozen people, including the bombers, were killed and 30 wounded. 40-year-old Samari Bakasia lost his wife in the attack. Bakasia says he fled the IDP camp with their 2-month-old baby because their safety could not be guaranteed.
Je fais la prière que Dieu nous protège dans cette histoire-là. Chaque jour, et ça nous inquiète trop.
Bakasia says they are scared and are now only relying on God to save them from terrorists. Cameroon's government says about 150 people deserted the camp that was home to about 500 Cameroonians fleeing increasing attacks by Boko Haram militants. In another incident, 2 female suicide bombers detonated when a self-defense group identified them as attackers headed to the camp. The bombers killed a member of the self-defense group and wounded at least a dozen people.
Nous avons reçu des vagues de blessés venant, n'est-ce pas, de Moura et de Kolofata. Il y a 7 femmes et 3 enfants.
Dr. Vohord Degumi says 17 women and 3 children, one barely a month and a half old, are among the wounded who have come from Kolofata and Moura in the past 24 hours. He says their patients refuse to return to the IDP camp once their treatment ends. It is the first time such attacks on IDPs have been reported. Most such incidents have targeted refugee camps for foreign nationals escaping Boko Haram. Last year, the Cameroonian government reported that suicide bombers were posing as refugees to attack the Minawawa refugee camp, which hosts at least 65,000 Nigerians. Soldiers were then deployed to the area and access to the camp strictly controlled. The governor of the far north region of Cameroon, Miji Yawa Bakari, says IDP camps need similar security measures, especially since 5 of 23 suicide bomb attacks recorded this year have occurred during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan that began several days ago. He is calling for vigilance, saying suicide bombers in disguise are trying to deceive Muslims engaged in acts of charity required by the Quran.
Nous saisissons cette occasion pour condamner ces actes barbares et rétrogrades, surtout en cette période de recueillement.
Mijiyawa says authorities are condemning the acts of barbarism that have increased during this period of fasting and intensive prayer. He says Boko Haram is still very active, looking for where it can attack, and no one should be deceived that the terror group has been defeated. He says self-defense groups should be created in all mosques and public places to assist the military in tracking suspects. The United Nations says that about 200,000 Cameroonians have been displaced by the ongoing Boko Haram conflict, 70% women and children. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Kolofata, Northern Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 21 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A ceasefire is in effect in South Sudan's Yei River State. The deal was signed yesterday in Uganda between a breakaway faction from the SPLA in opposition and the government. Vote counting continues in Lesotho, which held a snap election on Saturday, its third vote in 5 years. And a violent protest in The Gambia last Friday left one person dead and several others seriously wounded. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. There are bumper maize crops in South Africa and neighboring countries, but while supplies are good, the surplus has pushed down prices for farmers. Reuters reports South Africa alone has a maize surplus of 3.5 million tons this season. As a result, farmers are now looking to export maize to markets in Asia and the Middle East for the first time. Failure to do so could deal another blow to the economy. Maize would be used to feed animals in Asia and the Middle East rather than for human consumption. The HIV/AIDS epidemic has just entered its 37th year, and today, June 5th, has been designated HIV Long-Term Survivors Day. It's also been 21 years since highly active antiretroviral therapy became available in the U.S. Both milestones are being commemorated by the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program. It's the largest U.S. government program exclusively providing HIV care and treatment services to people living with HIV. More than 500,000 people benefit from the program. Dr. Laura Cheever is Associate Administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration. It's part of the Department of Health and Human Services. She says it's a time to celebrate and look ahead as the new faces of HIV have defied the odds by living for decades with the disease.
I think why it's so important now, or why we're really looking at it more closely, is because it's really a celebration of people living with HIV who are aging. They've survived through a time when they were diagnosed, when HIV was a death sentence, to getting these highly effective medications, taking them regularly, and growing old. In 2015, among patients that were seen in the context of the Ryan White program, 43% were over 50. As people age, it really is a new experience for all of us because we haven't had such a large cohort of older people living with HIV. And so we need to think about how we need to change how we provide services to meet the needs of the aging population with HIV. The good news is older people with HIV do extremely well. If we look at our data, it's very important for people with HIV to be virally suppressed, meaning they have access to medication, they're taking their medication regularly, and we cannot measure the virus in their blood. People that have undetectable viral loads live near normal lifespans with significantly reduced morbidity and mortality. Overall in the country, we have about 83% of people in our program that are virally suppressed. But among people over 50, it's almost 90%. So people that are older are really much better at taking their medications, remaining in care, and prioritizing their health care.
How has treatment changed over the years?
Oh, it's changed tremendously. Prior to 1995, we did not have drugs that significantly impacted a person's survival with HIV. Starting in 1995, we had medications, but they were incredibly complicated to take. When I prescribed medications at that time, most people had to take medications 5 times a day, 3 times a day on a rigid schedule, 2 times a day they needed to be having it with food, part of the time they had to take it without food. So their whole life revolved around taking their medications correctly. Now, for many people living with HIV that don't have resistance to the virus, they can be taking 1 pill once a day with very few side effects.
What are the main ways today that people are contracting HIV?
Most new cases are among men who have sex with men. We have done a great job in this country in terms of interacting with people who are injecting drugs. And so the number of new people who inject drugs or getting HIV has dropped considerably. I am actually quite concerned about the opiate epidemic in this country, which I'm sure you've heard about, and the fact that more and more people are injecting drugs. And so we do worry that that will be a significant rise for people who inject drugs infected with HIV. Of course, for women, a major factor is heterosexual sex.
How have perceptions and stereotypes changed over the years?
Unfortunately, the stigma around HIV and HIV diagnosis remains really high in this country. We have had a change in this country, a cultural change around acceptance of people who are gay. So I think that has helped. But still, there's a tremendous stigma about being HIV infected. And many people that are HIV infected continue to hide it from their family and hide it from the community, which makes getting care and taking care of themselves more complicated.
What are some of the misconceptions about contracting HIV?
Well, I think a lot of people who contract HIV don't necessarily consider themselves at risk, although they are at risk. Anyone having sex without a condom or other protection is at risk for HIV, and certainly gay men are at significant risk of HIV. Young people in particular, I think at times, don't weigh all those risks. I think it's not just around HIV infection, it's that other risks that younger people take, and that's a major barrier. The great news is that we do now have medication called pre-exposure prophylaxis, where someone who's at really high risk because of some of their behaviors, who's HIV negative, can take 1 pill once a day and really significantly reduce their risk of getting HIV infection. So it is possible, even for people that are in risky situations, to significantly reduce their risk. But many people don't know about that new option or take advantage of it.
What do you see in the future regarding HIV? Do you see perhaps a vaccine or perhaps a cure?
Yes, so I think NIH is working very hard at both cure and vaccine, and they've been working at that for a long time. I do not see that in my lifetime. I hope to have it, but I don't necessarily see it. The great news is that if people are on their medication and taking them every day, if they're virally suppressed, their risk of transmitting HIV to someone else is almost zero. So that we have many jurisdictions around this country, cities and states, that are working across their systems to significantly reduce that risk of transmission by making sure everyone is appropriately treated.
Dr. Laura Cheever is Associate Administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be up front with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a major computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. The 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment. celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.